Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. The future is cloudy for groups fighting to get those marijuana and anti-fracking proposals on the November ballot in Michigan. That's because the House last week gave final approval to SB 776. This bill sets up a strict 180-day window for groups to gather signatures on ballot initiative and constitutional amendment petitions. And the act would take effect immediately if Governor Snyder signs it. Our It's Just Politics team of Zoe Clark and Rick Pluta are with us now digging into all of this. Now, on the surface, it might seem like a modest change to election law in Michigan, but what kind of impact could it have on future ballot drives, Zoe?
Right. Modest, but so effective and somewhat controversial. So here's what's going on. You know, maybe you've been out and about, particularly now that the weather is warm and someone's like, hey, you want to sign my my petition here? You want to put your signature? Mm-hmm. Well, there's been a rule that any signature that's over 180 days, that then they just say, you know what, it's invalid. That if they turn in the petition signatures and after 180 days, the idea is like maybe you moved or gosh forbid, someone could have died who signed it. But now there is a group who is trying to get a question on the ballot who is pushing back on this idea of 180 days.
Using this thing called the rebuttal procedure. Rick, explain to us what this is, because it really hinges on all of this.
The way that it works, it's called rebuttable presumption, which is also my new band name. And what it says is that these signatures are presumed to be stale, are presumed to be invalid. But if you can prove that the person is still a registered voter, then the signature is counted again. And in the case of the anti-fracking and the marijuana ballot drives, that we know that they've got a lot of signatures that are over 180 days old. As a matter of fact, they acknowledge they can't get on the ballot unless they're counted. So what they want to do is just have the state check those names against its electronic database of voters. And what happened was a state elections panel said, you know, we're not going to change the rules. You're going to have to do it a different way, which is that you've got to go and get an affidavit from the voter, or you've got to get an affidavit from the local clerk for every single signature that you're trying to rescue, a task so arduous that the leader of the marijuana ballot drive said that it's the equivalent of chasing unicorns.
And now with this SB 776, that means forget that. Close that door. It isn't happening. You've got a hard, strict 180-day
whether
window.
You get it from the local clerk, the voter, or from the state's qualified voter file, the electronic database, it's still, if it's over 180 days, then it is no longer valid if Governor Snyder actually signs this into law.
TBD. But now let's turn to this question of immediate effect, because usually when the state legislature passes some act, it takes effect 90 days after final adjournment of the legislative session in which it was passed, right? How did I do?
Nicely done. I was quietly clapping.
Thank
in the
you.
Background.
So here's this Article 4, Section 27 in the state constitution that says lawmakers can give immediate effect to its acts if the measure passes with a two-thirds majority. But hey, SB 776 passed with 57 votes, and I'm the worst person in arithmetic in the world. I can tell 57 is not two-thirds of 109. Zoe, what's
right.
going on
it's,
here, guys?
Well, it's actually they're separate motions, and unlike the votes to adopt a bill, they're not record roll calls that you're supposed to stand or raise your hand or yell aye or something like that. However, we know, first of all, because of the record roll call votes and also because of the dissents that were filed in the official journal, that there's no mathematical way that Republicans had enough votes to qualify this bill for immediate effect so that it would take effect right away and affect ballot campaigns that are currently in the field and getting ready to turn in their signatures. However, this has been litigated before in a different case where Democrats sued Republicans, and what the Michigan Court of Appeals ruled, and it was a judge with a history with the Republican Party who wrote the opinion, said that we don't tell the legislature how to count votes. It's a separation of powers issue. So now Republicans can use whatever method they want to count, you know, votes for immediate effect, and no one can call foul unless this is somehow challenged again, maybe in a federal court that might say, you know what, if you're going to count votes, you have to use standard math.
And this has gotten Democrats, particularly with Republican control of both chambers and the executive branch, so riled up because Democrats feel like, hey, you just keep doing this. This is something that Rick and I have actually been covering back since 2012. And, you know, for those
of
you.
We spent a lot of time on IE,
this small little kind of procedural thing, but that has really changed some things. And Rachel Maddow, this was actually on MSNBC, one of the first things that she took to task before the Flint water crisis. This was her kind
immediate
of story
effect.
From Michigan was
but
immediate effect.
Democrats have used it in the past, too.
And this is the other thing that Rick and I, that this is what we explained that years ago, that look, this, again, because it's a parliamentary procedure, you know, Democrats have and likely in the majority would. And this is the conversation.
Oh, and have.
This
and
is
have.
What we're saying. Yeah. And absolutely have before.
And interesting how a federal appeals panel wrote about the use of immediate effect. Here was the quote. And this is a few years ago. Apparently, the Michigan legislature believes the Michigan Constitution can be ignored. Ouch.
I guess it depends on how you count the votes. Yes. I mean, look, they are ignoring the spirit, if not the letter of the Michigan Constitution, and justifying it by saying that both sides have historically done this, you know, which is true. However, you know, recent Republican legislatures have really brought it to new levels.
And finally, just very quickly, interesting to note that if some of these questions don't make it onto the ballot, if we don't have any ballot questions in November 2016, it would be the first time in a presidential year since 1988 that folks aren't voting on a statewide ballot.
Our It's Just Politics team of Zoe Clark and Rick Pluta, thanks for breaking this down for us and shedding light on that dark corner.
Thanks, Cindy.
Always a pleasure.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. It's time now for our weekly check-in with Michigan Radio Sports commentator John U. Bacon. John, I want to talk about recruiting, specifically the wooing and the courting that happens when a college or university-level coach has his or her eye on a hot prospect. In this case, a prospect is a 6-foot, 195-pound linebacker out of Florida. His name is Jesus Machado. He's been offered football scholarships from Michigan State, Alabama, West Virginia, North Carolina State, and Iowa State. And Jesus Machado is in eighth grade.
Man, think back for a second to you in eighth grade.
Oh, don't.
Nobody would have drafted me for anything that I know of. You're a mess. You're a hot mess at that age. So
and you're a kid.
You are a child. I mean, a 17-year-old to me is still a kid. Mm-hmm. A 13-year-old, a 14-year-old, this is beyond crazy. But that's the kind of, you know, musical chairs we have going on right now, that everyone's trying to get the right guys as fast as they can. And from Alabama's point of view, it's almost a no-loss situation, because if you bid on the guy and he ends up being all that, you can say when he's a 12th grader, hey, remember us? We were there on the ground floor. We're the first guy who loved you. And then if he washes out, watch them run away, because they will. So Alabama's got almost nothing to lose by doing this. In his case, of course, what it's going to do is warp any 13-year-old who's already been essentially drafted, if you will, by Alabama. It's that nuts.
And Michigan State. And
how you keep your head on straight at that point, I've got no idea.
Well, I mean, I to be honest, if I were this lad's mother, I'd be going, well, hey, it looks like, you know, college is covered. I'd be excited at the prospect of the scholarship.
But it's not.
Explain exactly what it means.
This commitment, if you will, is lowercase c, is not worth Kleenex. It means absolutely nothing, and Alabama proves this more than anybody every year. Until recently, they did what's called oversigning, where they get 35 guys allegedly on scholarship down to their camp in August. You've already committed to Alabama, you're about to be a student there, and they have them winnow down to the 25 scholarships they actually have to offer. So oversigning is a deeply cynical and damaging process that Nick Saban had mastered. What you're having on campus is basically a tryout for your team. So this poor guy might still have a commitment his senior year in high school, get to camp, and Saban says, you know what, we found somebody better, screw you. Every single Big Ten coach in the last recruiting cycle made more than 100 commitments. Now, you know that 100 student athletes are not going to show up on your campus. So everyone's playing the same game. Why? Because guess what? The players also dive out. It's very analogous to your kids applying for college. Hmm. That, you know, they might get into Michigan State and Kenyon and Harvard and who knows what else. They got to pick one out of that batch. And so they pick one. So the schools have got to do a game trying to figure out who's going to want to come to their school, how many are going to accept. And the kids got to play the same game of early admissions and all this other stuff, which is a cynical game also, by the way. Not as bad as this one, but this dance gets played out for other students as well.
In fact, we saw the story over the weekend. A defensive end from Toledo, his name's James Hudson, had committed to the University of Kentucky, which has been fishing hard in these Ohio schools. And then along came Michigan State and Alabama with scholarship offers. And the result was his message going, "Peace out, University of Kentucky. Thanks, but no thanks." And you say, this, of course, happens all the time.
Daily. And look, I mean, it kind of has to happen. I'm on the kid's side of this one.
Yeah.
If you get one offer when you're in 10th grade from a so-so, a very bad football program, and better offers from better programs down the road, what should you do? I mean, if you're the parent of that kid, you do what's best for the kid. So it's a cynical game on both sides, but one side of it, a bunch of 17-year-old kids. Mm-hmm. The other side is 50-year-old millionaires. So I'm automatically more sympathetic to the 17-year-old kid. How do you solve this problem? It's actually very easy, and the NCAA wants no part of it, and that is allow them to have actual commitments. These commitments are – they're not even verbal, by the way. I hate that phrase. It's actually an oral commitment, which means nothing whatsoever. I say let both sides say, if you want to commit – here's the national letter of intent. All right, go ahead and sign it now. And if the coach signs it and the player signs it, you are actually now committed. Anything short of that, you're dating. Okay? Mm-hmm. And dating's not marriage. Sorry. So it's not an I do. So call the bluff. And they don't want that because they like the system the way it is. It's to the advantage right now, largely, of the coaches.
Interesting. Good, interesting stuff. Michigan Radio Sports commentator John Eubankin. Feels different when you're a parent, doesn't it?
Even at 8 months. Although I can assure you, he's received no offers yet.
Thanks, John.
Thank you.
Still to come, we explore the evolution of fast food culture and see how changes in the food industry are affecting our economy and our young people. Stay with us. This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Fast food is an indelible part of our food landscape. It has forever altered the way we approach eating and the way we think of food. It means that, unlike our parents or grandparents, we don't have to plan ahead to figure out what's for dinner tonight. But fast food companies need to keep an eye to the future, including ways to keep young customers interested, young customers demanding fresher, tastier, healthier food. NPR and Youth Radio have teamed up to explore the changes in the food industry. Here's NPR Business and Planet Money correspondent Sonari Glinton.
Going to the grocery store, going to a Whole Foods or a Plum Market and having a glass of wine while you're eating at the salad bar, that is a really regular thing. It's not just happening in Ann Arbor and in Michigan, but it's happening all over the country and even in small towns and places where you wouldn't expect.
I talked with Sonari and with Youth Radio Storm White, looking into how economic and social forces are changing the food business. They're calling their series of reports Fast Food Scramble.
One of the things that we did this time was we went to Youth Radio and we said, what are you interested in and what kind of stories are you interested in? And the young people came back, and that has really been the cool thing, is engaging people where they are and working with reporters who are at a high level but 17.
And what are the big questions that you are exploring in these series of reports, Sonari?
Well, one of the things that's interesting about how our food culture has changed is that, you know, we would have thought that when the economic collapse happened that that would have been a great time for fast food, right? It's inexpensive and things like that. But that didn't happen. And as we came out of the downturn, we saw that breakfast was one of the few places where the food companies were doing well. And as we are coming out of the economy, we would expect these companies to be rebounding. And they are now this year. But they've been going through this sort of weird sort of existential angst, trying to figure out who they are and what they mean to the new consumer.
So talk to us a little about the fast food chains that we see in Michigan. So we've seen that pattern that, as you say, you would think that an economic collapse would really be a big boost. But at the same time, we're seeing such an uptick in people who want, you know, locally sourced food, and they want it to be healthy and they want it to taste real.
Yeah, I mean, a few years ago, you know, if just a name drop, say Zingerman's in Ann Arbor, the provenance of where this cheese came from, you might like joke about it. You know, that was a new edgy thing. But now when you go to a grocery store, they're like, this cheese comes from blank. You know, we want to know where our food comes from. We want to know that it's fresh. And that's why looking at it being made in front of us is really important. The rise of the grocerant. We want things quick. The grocerant is when, you know, at like, say, Plum Market, and you go and you get a salad. Or you can have food, or at any of the grocery store chains, almost all of them now do it, and they're becoming a bigger and bigger part of the profits of grocery stores because we're buying less of the food in the aisles.
And when we're talking about fast food, air quotes here, for the purposes of these reports, fast food scramble, so you're talking about the big names, the Burger Kings, the McDonald's, the, you know, the Pizza Hut, the KFCs that really help define fast food. But you're also talking about these grab and go at the grocery stores and convenience stores.
Well, what's interesting is that there's all this room. So when I was a kid, you only had a couple of choices, right? Yeah. When my mom was making dinner for me, it was you could buy food out at a chain, and it was usually Chinese takeout. Literally, these were almost only the possibilities. Chinese takeout, pizza, and the burger and chicken joints. I mean, there weren't that many more options. Then there was she could make food at home or have a frozen dinner. But now you can go to a grocerant where there's go to the grocery store and there's food prepared. You can have your food delivered to you. Companies like Uber are getting into the game, along with Grubhub and all those other places. They're filling in these gaps between, you know, cooking dinner for yourself and sitting down at a high-quality restaurant. The cafeteria and the automat, two things that we thought would have been as dead as the Etzel, are really, really right here, and they're really important in part because of labor costs.
Stormwide, I'm curious, what interested you and the Youth Radio team about this story? I guess what? Fast food. What's not to love, right?
Well, I can say that as a student, one of the hardest things for me personally is finding a healthy meal that is not so expensive that I can have access to. And I think that working at Youth Radio with young people, that's something we can kind of relate to, is that easy meals are hard to find without breaking your pockets as a young person. So I think that's what interested us as a group.
And speaking of not breaking your wallet, tell us about this interactive map, Storm, that you and the team have developed and this $5 challenge.
Well, the young people at Youth Radio decided that they wanted to challenge people in finding cheap food in their area that isn't necessarily fast food or traditional fast food, and to turn that information into something really cool, an interactive map.
How can we interact with your map?
So it's really easy. All you have to do is send a picture on Twitter or Instagram of your favorite $5 meal. In your description, make sure to tell us what it is, where you bought it, how much you paid for it, and use the hashtag $5 challenge. You'd have to spell out the word dollar and use the number 5. And don't forget to mention us at Youth Radio.
Sonara, can we really have fast food with a conscience?
Of course you can. It just costs more money. And there is so much technology and economies of scale. As we demand things of these gigantic food conglomerates, they are responding. I mean, McDonald's is responding, has responded to calls from people who wanted more sustainable approaches to doing fast food. I mean, these big companies, we're their customers, we're their dollars, and what we put in our body is important, and letting them know what we want. And we've been doing it with our dollars and our pocketbooks. That's why the fast casual boom is so big. That's why companies, I mean, we look at a place like Panera or Chipotle now and like, oh, it's just Panera or Chipotle. But when you realize these were global changes that happened to get fresh food that you can look at in front of you. And right now, that is where everything is. That is where all the churn in the industry is. The number of people who come into restaurants is down. It's down at fast food restaurants. But the number of people going into these fast casual places, and they range fast casual, like I said, ranges from everything from Chipotle to Panera Bread to Zingerman's to, you know, any number of smaller restaurants. I mean, to fill in the gaps. And that's really where it is. All of us are looking for a meal at 4 o'clock We don't know what time. We, you know, at 4 o'clock, 80% of us don't know what we're having for dinner.
That's amazing.
And, right? You can get a healthy meal in Michigan right now if you want to. And there's either the technology is bringing it to you or you're demanding it of the people who exist already.
Fast Food Scramble can be heard through the month of May during All Things Considered here on Michigan Radio. And then, of course, Storm White and the team at Youth Radio have produced this interactive map and the $5 challenge. Very fun. Sonari Glinton with NPR and Storm White is with Youth Radio. And again, it's the Fast Food Scramble and the $5 challenge. Thanks so much to both of you for being with us on Stateside.
Thank you.
It's been a pleasure.
Well, here's a great way to learn some Motor City history, served up by writer Bill Loomis. It's his newest book, On This Day in Detroit History. Bill takes us all the way back through Detroit's 314-year history. Bill Loomis is with us again. Well, the title certainly lets us know what we're getting. There's That's right. one piece of history for every day, spanning more than three centuries. That had to be a pretty tall order.
Yeah, it was. I thought it'd be easy because I write rather long pieces for the Detroit News and other magazines, and there's a lot of stuff that's on the cutting floor. So I thought, well, I'll just paste them together, bada bing, bada boom. But it was much harder than I thought.
Something tells me there was no bada bing, bada boom about this because
it was 2 years.
2 years to put this together. Yeah. How did you do it? I mean, there's so many sources, and we're spanning more than three centuries, and you've got to fill 365 slots.
Well, that's right. Well, I put a big whiteboard calendar, a 300-year calendar on the wall, and then you just start filling them in. But you need to keep it balanced. I got a lot of the way through it, and my informal readers were all saying, you have everything from the 19th century. You don't have very much from the 20th century. And then you want to represent each group that's contributed to Detroit's history, and you want to have the events. So it wasn't that easy. And one of the things I learned, Cynthia, is everything happens in the summer. Nothing happens in the winter.
Oh, that's funny.
Oh, yeah. It was a real pain.
Did you have any specific criteria in deciding, okay, this makes the book, this doesn't?
You know, in general, I did. My wife is an educator and involved with high school education. So she says, you got to have more educational stuff. So, okay. So we did that. And then I wanted to, of course, touch on important dates, the founding of the city, the Great Fire of 1805, mm-hmm. Things like that. And then just fun stuff. That's my own take on things. And just everyday stuff that was kind of quirky. And then also nostalgic things for some older readers, you know.
Readers of a certain vintage,
yes,
shall
that's,
we say.
That's right.
All right. Well, let's kind of skip through the year and we can get a sampling of some of the interesting things that you have decided to share with us, starting with January 28th, 1850.
Yeah, that was one of those quirky things. I call it kissing like you mean it, but it was from 1850. Out of the Free Press, and it was just about how girls don't kiss like they should. And I thought, I didn't even know they talked about that kind of stuff, but they certainly did. A lot of it. You'd be amazed.
All right. So 1850. Go 1850.
Yeah, there you are.
All right. We go to March 16th, 1908. Oh, yeah. And right. Boy, there's a famous name, Harry Houdini.
Well, Harry Houdini used to come to Detroit quite frequently. And the bellhops, these young guys, would lock him in his room as sort of to see if they could trap Houdini. And, you know, he'd get out of these incredible tricks and things like that, and yet he'd get trapped in his room by these kids, and he'd be furious and miss dates and stuff like that.
So on this day, March 16th on this day, of 1908.
That's right. He was in the St. Clair Hotel, and the boys locked him in his room, and he couldn't get out, and he had to. He was embarrassed and all that kind of thing.
We go ahead now to April 7th, 1870. And this is certainly something that historically is extremely important. So we had...
Right. The 15th Amendment. And one of the things I do like is how do local Detroiters respond to major events? Mm. So say Abraham Lincoln's assassination, or in this case... what was the reaction to the 15th Amendment ratification in 1870? And that's the one where everyone gets the right to vote, that they guarantee the right to vote no matter who you are, mm-hmm. as long as you're male.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we had to deal with that female thing a little later down the road.
That's a little off. But anyway, you understand. And it was it's just this beautiful parades. There were a lot of African-Americans in Canada and in Detroit and in the outskirts, and they all came together in Detroit and had a big parade. Mm-hmm. And then they had a celebration at the Detroit Opera House with each of these young women dressed with the state's banners that ratified the amendment. So it's a very cute – it just went on, really charming, just exuberant happiness at the event.
Great day in history. We don't think of tornadoes hitting Detroit, but on June 26th, 1875,
right.
You bring us something that I think would make – it certainly would make huge headlines were it to happen today.
Well, that's right. Tornadoes back then, there was no warning signals or anything. Yeah. There was no weather reports or anything at all. So
you got what you got.
You just suddenly – you're sucked out the window, and that's what happened to people. And what was amazing about this particular day was that it hit a German section, and these were German immigrants who'd never heard of tornadoes or ever mm-hmm. seen tornadoes. So they thought at first it was coal smoke flying up into the air, and then suddenly they're getting flung into trees, and right as they're having dinner, they're getting sucked out the windows of their homes and stuff like that.
And so this was right in Detroit?
Right in Detroit. That's right. Mm. Right on the west side of Detroit.
That was something. On a lighter note, July 3rd, 1904, I say to myself, I'm not letting Bill out of here without talking about Monk Perry, who is?
The first monkey to drive a car in Detroit. Monk Perry.
Where did you find this?
Sensation. This one, it took me a long time, but it was one of those ones I had to include it. He drove right up at Brush and Alexandrian Street and was a smash hit.
He was with a circus, I take it?
He wasn't just driving to work or something. No, he was with the circus. But
That was in 1904.
Yeah.
August 10th, 1950. There's a reference here, and I couldn't let this go without talking about the anyone who grew up in Southeast Michigan who is a baby boomer. When I say the words Milky the Clown, people go, oh.
Well, that's right. That's that nostalgic piece. I actually worked for Twin Pines in college and a little after. And so,
For those who didn't watch Milky the Clown, mm-hmm. how do you even begin to describe him?
It was a local show that featured this fellow. His name was Cummins.
Clare Cummins.
And he did magic tricks. And he had
the fact that it was sponsored by Twin Pines, you had to have that milk tie-in.
That's right. And in those days, that was real evident. They were always referring to Twin Pines and Milky the Clown and the magic words and things like that.
I think Twin Pines was the big magic word when you played a game.
That's right. That's right. And there were tickets were in demand. I mean, it was a two-year waiting list to get on that show.
I always wanted to. So August 10th, 1950, was that Milky's first show?
That was what started it all. And he went on and eventually retired because the company he worked for a paint company, said, you're spending too much time doing that. Back to work.
I will share with you when I was on with WKBD in, I want to say it was 1988 or 89.
Oh,
he
yeah.
came back.
Oh, did he?
To be on the Children's Miracle Network Telethon. And I have a beloved picture.
That's very cute.
That someone blew up for me of as I was interviewing Milky. He reached behind my ear and he pulled out a quarter. And it's one of my treasured professional memories.
There you go.
September 6th, 1964. I also promised myself that I was not letting you out without talking about what happened. September 6th, 1964.
Right. The Beatles came to Detroit at Olympia Stadium. It was
right there on Grand River.
The big deal for a lot of teenagers and preteens. Mm-hmm. I'll say I never got to go, but nevertheless.
Neither did I. I've spoken about my immense disappointment. But as you have the fun pop culture and these social things, you really do have many, many other important dates. Like you take us to June 29th, 1990, when Nelson Mandela was in Detroit.
Right.
And so many interesting things. It's lots of fun to go through. It's like, you can't eat just one, like salted peanuts.
No, you realize how rich Detroit's history is. It's just incredible having done this. It's really I really love doing this book.
What was the one? Do you have one event, one entry where you just said, wow, where your jaw hit the ground?
Well, I think the visit of Nelson Mandela was really pretty amazing. I didn't realize at the time how important that really was to Detroit. And that was just a very moving thing. And how he said how Motown music really kept him going when he was in prison. And so it was it's a very touching thing.
It's a lot of fun. Bill Loomis's newest book, On This Day in Detroit History. Bill, always great talking with you. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Cindy.
And if you missed the show on the radio, it is very easy to catch us on iTunes. Just search for Stateside. And while you're there, please give us a review because we'd really like to hear what you think. Up next, self-driving cars will change many dimensions of our lives.
Our cities, our streets, our homes, how we think about getting around.
Looking into a future with autonomous vehicles. Then, our newest contributor to The Next Idea, we'll talk about how Michigan can make the move to cleaner sources of energy. That's in 10 minutes. This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. There are lots of us hearing the talk about self-driving cars and perhaps shrugging it all off as wishful thinking or science fiction. But self-driving vehicles are here. They won't eliminate cars, but there will be fundamental changes in the way that we relate to them. Andrew Hoffman is the Holson Professor at the Ross School of Business at the University of Michigan. He's also the Education Director at the Graham Sustainability Institute. Andy, your essay in theconversation.com kind of caught our eye. You look at the big picture for self-driving cars and you ask a question. What will the world look like in 2078? That's when today's college freshman class will be like me and be grandparents. So what will self-driving vehicles be like then?
Just to help position the conversation, I opened the essay by pointing out that my grandmother was born in 1895 and died in 1990. And in her lifetime, she saw indoor plumbing, indoor electrification, the horse go to the car, airplanes, jet travel, the computer. She saw all that in
space
one lifetime.
Travel. Yeah. Wow. Yeah.
And so kids today will see that kind of change. So let's move beyond the science fiction conversation. The world that they will pass away in is going to be so different. I think two areas that will be so fundamentally different are mobility and electricity. What I study are cultures, how they shift, how they evolve. And so I'm just fascinated by all the cultural dimensions that could come along with a shift in our desired form of mobility. I mean, just to put it in more immediate terms, think of what the iPhone has done to our conceptions about access to information, access to connectivity. I could say, you know what, Cynthia, I'll meet you in Lansing at 3 o'clock on Sunday. We'll figure it out when we get there.
Absolutely.
I mean, it totally changes. So the whole idea of driverless cars will change so many dimensions of our cities, our streets, our homes, how we think about getting around.
If you were to kind of imagine what the future could be like, what would this transportation or mobility be like?
Let's imagine, first of all, that parking lot out front. We don't need that anymore. I will finish this interview and I'll take out my cell phone and I'll call a car, just like I would do with Uber right now. Mm-hmm. I'll just do it for a car that doesn't have a driver. And I will call it. I will choose a mobility provider that is very good at getting me the car I want right away. Just like right now, I'll pick Verizon or any other cell phone company because I like the service they provide. And so the car will come. It'll pick me up. It'll take me where I need to go. I'll get out. It will go off and take care of somebody else. That will mean more efficient use of cars. Think about the airline model.
Yes.
Airlines make money because that plane is idle as little as possible. Mm-hmm. Mobility providers in the future will make money by having that car idle as little as possible. That means less cars on the road. Right now, the average car is parked 95% of the time. We would need enough cars to satisfy peak load, peak demand at rush hour, but that would still be significantly less cars than they have right now. Do we need as many roads in a world like that? Do we need those parking garages in downtown Ann Arbor? Do you need the parking garage at your house? Hmm. What will this do for people with disabilities or senior citizens? They won't have to give up their freedom to get around.
An enormous culture shift for us.
Yes, very much so. You go out to a restaurant, you have too much to drink. The car takes you home.
No more DUIs.
Yeah. But it's also, think about it both in the plus and the minus. I mean, it's not always positive. I mean, certain people will lose their jobs, taxi drivers, Uber drivers. One place that people talk about the first application of driverless technology is in long-haul trucking. What will happen to truckers? Going with that, if you have driverless cars that are safer, then insurance rates, if you choose to drive, will go up for you and less for the driverless car. If they're safer, what will that do to speed limits on the highway? What will that do to the lane width on the highway? If you can be precisely down the middle of that lane, will cars and trucks draft off each other?
Boy, you're just riffing away. You're right.
Well, it's just fun. A lot of people think about this. Everything I'm giving here, I'm not making up off top of my head. There's a wonderful line I like to present to my students. It's by William Gibson. He said, "The future is already here. It's just not very evenly distributed." And so there are people seeing this reality now. I look at my young students. They don't want to own a car. I will actually provoke them in class by saying, "I love cars." And they look at me like I have three heads. People in urban centers don't want to own cars. They just want the service that it provides. There are legal issues that have to be worked out, and some think those are greater than the technological issues.
What do you see as some of these legal issues, Andy?
Well, CAR will have an algorithm to make decisions. M-City, it's a whole lab to try and figure that out. You get a faded sign. Can it read it?
Yeah.
Can it
real-world conditions.
Yeah, can it see curbs, different configurations of curbs? What happens when the car is faced with a bad or worse decision? Do I hit the pedestrian or do I hit the bus? You can see the lawsuits flying there.
Yes. And I also feel that I don't want to be the driver in that car as it's deciding.
Right, right. And then, you know, certainly what will this do to public transportation? What will this do to poor people? Will they still be able to get around if people start to move towards personal mobility? What will it do to the bus systems and who will be hurt by that? So just connecting the technology with the culture. I mean, one dimension that I like to toy with, I have two classic cars. I really do love cars. If the future is electric and driverless, the gas station goes away. Where do I get my gas? Mm-hmm. I'll have to buy it at a specialty store. How do I maintain it? The mechanic is gone, so I'll have to rely on certain clubs. And those do exist, people having private clubs where they park their classic cars and try and work it out. And it will start slowly. They're talking about geofencing, that's the term. But there will be certain areas, whether it's an urban center, you can get around in Manhattan with this, but you can't go to Yonkers. Maybe it'll happen in downtown Ann Arbor, but you can't take it all the way to Pinckney. It will start slowly. It will start to grow. The developing world will be behind on this one or perhaps ahead because maybe they want to leapfrog. Why go through the phase of car ownership if you can step all the way to driverless cars?
It makes me feel like we're on that buffer zone that we saw. Let's go back to 1895 when, maybe one guy in town had that new horseless carriage and everybody, as they were hitching up their horses, were kind of looking at it going, what is that?
Yeah. Now, but there were people that were doing some things that weren't right. But think back to Steve Jobs when he started Apple Computer. He said, "I envision a day when we'll have a computer in everyone's home." And I, like everyone else, thought this is nuts. And now imagine a home without a computer.
Or what we're carrying in our hand, to harken back to what you said about our smartphones.
Yeah.
Michigan, Andy, is a state that has historically supported so many men and women, so many families, through production of cars and trucks. So do you see self-driving vehicles as being a boon or a bust for our state?
It all depends on how the auto companies adapt to this. GM has bought into Lyft.
Yeah.
They certainly see the future. The other companies are looking at it. This is not off their radar.
No, not at all. Well, they're in fact, it's about transportation.
Yeah. Ford has been talking about mobility for a long time.
Yeah.
Dave Burdish at Ford was really pushing this. They're watching it, and they're also recognizing, you know, there's a nice provocation by Amory Lovins at the Rocky Mountain Institute. He says, "What is the car of the future? Is it a car with a computer, or is it a computer on wheels?" And that really gets you to think differently. And if in his mind it's the latter, it's a computer on wheels, so who should make it? Apple, Google, Siemens. Guess what? They're here, folks. And the auto companies recognize that their competitors are not just the other major auto companies. And look what Tesla has done. Mm-hmm. I mean, all the auto companies said electrics can't work. Elon Musk said, yes, they can, and he's pushed it forward. They announced the Model 3. People had to plunk down $1,000 to get an order. 275,000 people did it in 2 days. He raised $275 million in 2 days for people that want the Model 3. The majors are now chasing, and Chevy is right there with the Bolt.
Yes, it is.
And a lot of people think that Tesla had to push forward the announcement of the Model 3 because the Bolt was coming out. So the race is on. The competition is engaged, and they're part of it. They're not sitting by idly, as some would suggest they've done in the past.
Fascinating stuff. And you'll find Andrew Hoffman's essay in theconversation.com. Of course, he is with the Ross School of Business and the Graham Sustainability Institute at the University of Michigan. Always great talking with you.
Oh,
thank you.
Oh, same here, Cynthia.
You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio.
Creation.
Part of the community. The next idea.
It doesn't always look like the dots connect, but they do.
There is no escaping the sheer enormity of the challenge of climate change. We need to come up with solutions for our planet, and that can leave us as individuals feeling very helpless, as though there's very little we can do to make a difference. But our latest contributor to The Next Idea is here to offer an idea to help us on a statewide level to help Michigan make the move to cleaner sources of energy. The idea? To make renewable energy investments profitable and low risk. And that brings in rapid and willing investment by the private sector. Sam Gomberg is an energy analyst at the Midwest Office of the Union of Concerned Scientists. Good to have you with us today, Sam.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Let's set the stage, if we can. What is the energy and profile in Michigan right now? And by that, I guess I'm looking for what percent of our electricity comes from fossil fuels?
Currently, Michigan gets about 60% of its electricity from fossil fuels, about 50 or so percent from coal, and another 6, 7, or 10% from natural gas, depending sort of on the prices and so forth.
And while we're doing that, then, how much carbon is emitted every year from our electric power plants?
Oh, about 60 million tons. So really an enormous amount of carbon is emitted from Michigan's power plant each year.
And when it comes to carbon emissions, Sam, do we have any sense of how quickly the public sector is responding to the push to reduce emissions?
It really depends on your perspective. If you're looking at this in the perspective of addressing climate change and avoiding the worst impacts of climate change, then the electricity sector is not responding nearly quick enough. That being said, if you're looking at the transition to renewable energy and so forth, I mean, we are definitely seeing some progress, but the challenge of climate change is so critical and urgent that we need to be moving past it.
And your essay for The Next Idea offers one way to push ahead with something called a green bank. What is that?
A green bank is essentially a private-public partnership to drive investment in things like clean energy resources that are profitable to the private sector, but also provide a lot of societal benefits to all of us that we want to try to capture.
It, as you say in your essay, you're not talking about energy-efficient windows and insulation, although certainly we need those, but you're talking about power plant-sized projects, aren't you?
I am. And so, you know, our organization started looking into this and looking into these types of programs. Several states have small programs that look to drive investments in things like efficient windows and insulation in the walls and rooftop solar on houses, which is all good, and we need that. But I, you know, this idea of a green bank and this public-private partnership can be scaled up to a much larger scale to look at the enormous investments that we need in things like power plant size projects.
So here in Michigan, Sam, what kinds of projects would make the most difference, perhaps in the fastest amount of time? Because as you say, the clock is ticking here.
Sure. From my perspective, if we're looking at the biggest bang for your buck in terms of climate change, we're looking at obviously renewable energy, onshore wind farms, looking at the potential of offshore wind farms, solar at a utility scale, so large scale solar where you can really achieve the economies of scale that make it very cost effective, and then big energy efficiency projects, things like retrofitting Michigan school systems or public buildings. We're looking at industrial energy efficiency. So really tackling some of the really large energy users in Michigan and then doing wholesale energy efficiency retrofits on a very large scale that requires a big investment.
And why would green energy projects like this be attractive to investors, Sam?
Because they either make money or they save money. So one of the things and one of the reasons why this idea can work so well at this point is because we've seen really rapid declines in the price of things like wind and solar. So wind and solar have come down, you know, 60% or more in price over the last several years. So they're cost competitive right now with things like coal plants and natural gas plants and the other typical resources that we think of for producing electricity. So the investment potential is definitely there. What we need is to just drive it much more rapidly. And so a green bank can help bring down some of these barriers, whether it is helping to offset or reduce risk in the loans. So if I may, when a bank or a financing institution is looking to invest in something, they're looking at two things. One, can it possibly make money? And two, what is the risk that, my assumptions are wrong? So what is the risk that things will go wrong in this investment? And so a green bank type program can really help reduce that risk, particularly for new and emerging sectors. So if I'm looking to invest my money and I don't know much about wind and solar power, then it's harder for me to sort of talk myself into investing in that when I know that I've made money on something like a coal plant or a natural gas plant previously, and I feel more comfortable with that. It's not necessarily a numbers-based, but almost sort of a gut check type thing. And big investors go through this process as well. So when you have something like a green bank, a public institution saying, listen, we'll chip in a little, we'll put our money where our mouth is on this, and help reduce some of that risk or help you understand that this risk profile is actually very manageable, then you start to, then the financing sector comes in and says, oh, well, I see this as a much better investment than I did previously, and I want to put my money here. So you start to drive a lot of that investment just by reducing some of those risk profiles, reducing some of those administrative costs, those types of things.
So the idea is attractive. What would it take, Sam, to get a green bank started in Michigan?
Well, it would take an initial surge of public funding. We did an analysis looking at Michigan and estimated, based on the experience of smaller green bank programs around the country, that an initial public investment of about $100 million could drive about $3 billion in investments in renewable energy and energy efficiency over the next 15 years. So leveraging basically private capital at a ratio of about $7.5 to 1, which is a very reasonable, almost conservative assumption. But then it also continues to grow because you are taking that money and instead of sort of handing it out in direct subsidies, you're reinvesting it. So they may be issuing loans, and then as they get payment back on those loans, they're reinvesting those payments back into the program. So it is a self-sustaining type of design that allows for to continue to grow and so forth. But it does take an initial public investment to get it off the ground and to get it to scale up very quickly.
And what do you see happening, you and the Union of Concerned Scientists see happening, if we continue at our current pace of weaning ourselves from fossil fuel use?
It is hard to imagine that we will achieve the levels of carbon reduction necessary to avoid what we consider and what the scientists have told us will be catastrophic impacts from climate change. So a lot of people have probably heard about this sort of 2 degrees Celsius threshold that we really have to rein in our emissions of carbon to avoid surpassing that sort of increasing the global temperature is more than 2 degrees. That's when things really start to look bad for the society that we built and being able to adapt to the changes that we're seeing. And the pace that we're at right now simply is not going to get us to that level of carbon emission reductions. Things are ramping up, certainly, across the globe, but we need to see them ramp up more quickly. That's really the driver and the rationale for this public sector investment to get the private sector moving more quickly, is that the societal benefits justify that public sector investment. So the societal benefits of not just reducing carbon emissions, but also reducing all of the societal impacts of our fossil fuel addiction, including air pollution and water pollution and so forth. There's a real economic cost to those things. And so it justifies making a public investment to get the private sector moving more rapidly.
Sam Gomberg is an energy analyst with the Midwest Office of the Union of Concerned Scientists. His essay can be found on the Next Idea page at michiganradio.org. Sam, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Support for the Next Idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.
Today's Stateside was directed by Ellie Billings. Our executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Today's engineer was Rusty Brock. Contributors are Cass Adair, Melissa Benmark, Mike Blank, Tony Brown, Ryan Grimes, Josh Hakala, Mercedes Mejia, Lindsay Scullin, Kate Summers, and Carl Williams. Stateside's a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thanks so much for listening.